Illegal art sounds like something that could only exist in some kind of police state nightmare. The colors you are using are forbidden. You will have to come with us. But the way things have unfolded in the 21st century, artists can run afoul of the law without really trying. Colors might not be copyrighted, but just about everything else is. Artists have traditionally used found materials, sounds, and images from their cultural environment, drawn inspiration from previous works, or referred to existing artifacts and images to make a statement or critique. But more than ever, anything that might be vaguely creative is treated as intellectual property. Throw in a bunch of lawyers, add digital technology, and you wind up buying CDs that won't play on your computer because the industry fears you'll make a copy. I'm Jack Brighton, and during this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about the impact of copyrights and our conceptions of intellectual property on the free expression of artists. We have two guests joining us. Carrie McLaren is the curator of an exhibit entitled Illegal Art, which is touring museums in the United States. The Illegal Art exhibit opened in New York last year and recently appeared in Chicago and San Francisco and is heading for Philadelphia in October. The exhibit includes images, video, and audio pieces and other elements, and we'll talk about that with Carrie McLaren during this hour. She's also editor of a magazine called Stay Free, and we'll talk about that as well. Our other guest is Siva Vaidyanathan. He's professor of culture and communication at New York University and author of the book Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity, published by the New York University Press. As we talk with them about the conflict between art and copyright, intellectual property, etc., you are invited into the conversation. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, around the Midwest here or via the internet anywhere in the U.S., 800-222-9455. And our guests, Carrie McLaren and Siva Vaidyanathan, both join us by telephone. Good morning. Are you both there?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, great. Glad to have you with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Carrie McLaren, to start with, would you tell us a bit about your exhibit, Illegal Art?
Well, we started it around November of last year. It opened in New York, and the idea was to gather artists whose work runs on the fringes of intellectual property law in one way or another. Some of the artists have had, run into legal troubles. Other artists haven't. We wanted to sort of look at this gray area in copyright and also trademark infringement. Because of a lot of the ways that these issues are decided, this can be, changes depending on where depending on the parties involved, depending on where it's happening, that sort of thing. So it's a visual art exhibit. It's also a film. We have a series of film screenings. We put out a CD. It's a multimedia project.
The example of music that we played to start with is one of those elements that, each of these things, I'm sure, has its own story.
Right. Oh, I was going to mention in your intro, there are some colors that are trademarked. They're not copyrighted, but I don't know if anyone's tried to use the Pepsi blue, but there have been instances of anyway.
colors being trademarked.
Right.
Is it trademarked? This is part of the problem because there's trademarks, there's copyrights, there are patents, and all these things are ways of locking up rights to use various things.
They are, but each area of regulation, each area of the law has its distinct functions. And like any area of the law, there can be ways to construct a system that works really well and provides the incentives that are necessary, and then there are ways to go way overboard. And what Carrie has documented through this exhibit is a variety of ways that our regulatory systems for culture and information have gone way overboard. And this has the counterproductive effect of stifling creativity when these areas of law are actually supposed to foster increased creativity, increased dialogue. They're supposed to fill our libraries with books. They're supposed to fill our lives with music. But we're actually seeing now that when those laws get too strong, they have two effects. They stifle creators because everyone's afraid of getting sued, and in many cases have been sued, mm-hmm. and they also undermine public faith in these areas of the law.
Yeah. Well, it's really interesting. A lot of the recent, you know, at least media coverage of these issues surrounds, you know, the whole Napster phenomenon and the efforts of the recording industry to crack down on illegal file sharing. And so, you know, the argument is, well, you know, people are just stealing music, basically. And that sort of simplifies the whole dilemma.
You know, there probably are people who are doing something close to stealing, but that's a metaphorical association that doesn't quite fit the behavior. There are certainly unethical ways to use other people's content, and there are very ethical ways of using other people's content. What we have now, though, is unfortunately a pretty shallow conversation about this issue, because it's not good versus evil. By any means, at any level. It really is an exposure of the complicated ways that we use music in our lives, the complicated ways that we use culture in our lives. And what we're seeing is the fact that human beings tend to use culture by sharing, because it's worthless if you keep it at home. You know, a song doesn't matter if you can't groove to it with your friends. And a song matters less if you can't build on it and take from it and share it and splice it up and mess with it, because that's how creativity happens. And now it's becoming so obvious that this is how human beings love to relate to each other. However, we have institutions, some of them very rich and powerful, who have structured our laws and our regulatory systems to make that sort of behavior, in some cases, prohibitively expensive. On the other hand, we have technologies that have made it so incredibly cheap and easy to do that. So it's a really interesting time to examine these issues. But the conversations are being driven to extremes, you know, extremes of anarchy or extremes of oligarchy. And there are probably better ways to have this conversation than we have so far.
Mm-hmm. Carrie, let me ask you to talk about the cut that we just played. It's one of the cuts that's on the CD that you are making available as part of the show, I believe. That was a cut by The Verve called Bittersweet Symphony, and I think a lot of people recognize that. But there's quite a story behind that song.
Well, there is. Yeah, they sampled. I think it was about 4 seconds from a obscure Rolling Stones live track, and they ended up running into a lot of legal troubles with the Stones, and who, you know, demanded, I can't remember how much money they wanted for that, but they first it was going to be a lawsuit, and they ended up settling, and as part of the settlement, the Stones actually got credited for co-writing the song, and ended up, when it won a Grammy, the song won a Grammy, and so the Stones actually had something to do with accepting the award. I mean, it's
amazing.
It's insane. Were you going to say something?
Oh, I also understand that the Stones essentially made all the royalties on the song because of that. I mean, they had such a strong bargaining position. By being the established creator, you are in the position of ultimate power in this sort of rights management marketplace. You can dictate the terms,
right.
And the emerging creator, the next guy, is in such a bind, has to bow to the pressure of the established. And we're talking about the Rolling Stones, a band that built its entire career building on the works of others,
mm-hmm.
including their name, which they got from Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
They incidentally, both the tracks, the Verve track and the Rolling Stones track, are on our website. I mean, when we put out the CD and put out all these examples of artists who have, you know, run into copyright issues, we put the originals along with them so that people could compare the songs.
That's right. Well, and as you say, it samples about 4 seconds of the original recording, I believe, from The Last Time, the song by the Rolling Stones.
It might even be 4 bars.
My
memory's a little sketchy on this, but it was a small amount.
Well, to add to the irony, then I guess Nike approached The Verve about using the song in the commercial, and then there was another sort of thorny knot to untie as far as the rights go. That, you know, they eventually said, okay, but we'll donate the fee to charity, because otherwise,
right.
You know, Nike will go to the Stones manager, publisher, and he'll, you know, whatever, he'll even get more money out of it or something. I'm not sure. But and the thing that Siva Vaidyanathan mentioned about the Rolling Stones extracting so much material throughout their career from previous blues artists. This is something that I think is worth considering at some length, because when you talk about art, art isn't, you know, it's built on a foundation of tradition or the work of previous artists. It's not something that, you know, any one artist can say, well, I created my art from scratch.
Yeah, but, you know, sometimes people make that argument, and they make it in a way that I think is pretty insincere. You know, when artists are beginning their careers and they're very happy to credit their influences, their inspirations, they tend to be less defensive about it. I've noticed that as artists or as entire industries have matured, they start getting a lot more protective, a lot more defensive, a lot more arrogant about their relationship with the political economy of culture, and they end up causing a lot of trouble for other people. They end up bullying other people, and we've seen that happen with Microsoft, and we've seen it happen with Mark Twain. I mean, it's a trajectory that that artists and companies and entire industries go through. The American film industry was built on the tradition of lifting plots, characters, and ideas from novels, not paying for them, not crediting
sure.
them, and rolling out, you know, narrative experimental films. And, you know, this is how D.W. Griffith built his entire career, especially in the early years. And now the American film industry is the most vigilant in terms of enforcing rights, yet it's, of course, perfectly willing to exploit the shrinking public domain for cartoons and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, American music was built in the same way. It was built on the foundations of traditions from Africa, from the Caribbean, from, you know, Irish traditional music, and essentially the blues came from, you know, those traditions as expressed through, you know, slave culture in the South.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have instances where, you know, the music started to become popular, and then white artists made the copyright of it.
Well, you know, that's the very flattened out story of what happened. Often it was the companies, and the companies that abused their labor forces were owned both by black executives and white executives. So there wasn't a monopoly on exploitation. But we do know that people were treated unfairly in the history of American popular music, especially as it became a big, powerful industry. And that tradition of exploitation has never really ended. It just became equal opportunity exploitation. So now white artists get abused just as much as black artists do, and I'm not sure that we can even call that progress. Unfortunately, it is the way that the economy sort of grown up. Now, with new technologies, we're actually seeing white artists and black artists look at the system historically, look at their level of exploitation, and ask themselves the basic question: do we need these intermediaries? Do we need these troublemaking companies, or can we make a more direct connection with our fans?
Mm-hmm.
And people are starting to ask that question, and it's a healthy question to ask them. And some are finding that they can create those direct connections, and some are finding that it's still worth going through established channels. So we have a much more interesting or developing a matrix of distribution now, and we have more questions than answers about what's going to happen with the music industry. But it's becoming painfully clear. And if you look at the exhibit that Carrie's put together, the illegal art exhibit, what you see are affronts to common sense and affronts to artistic sensibility because of the bullying attitudes of some of these stakeholders.
Yeah, and I want to ask Carrie to talk a little bit more. We talked quite a bit about music, but it's not just music, obviously. It's images as well, and you know the vehemence with which they are defended by the copyright holders. There are a number of examples, and you give them on your website, and I'd love to see the exhibit, of people using images, you know, to create art, but maybe got in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a Canadian painter named Natalka Hussar who has taken some old Harlequin novels and ripped the cover off and then painted over the cover, put it on her own image, kept the type of overarching look of the Harlequin novel, changed and kept the title. And she was pursued by Harlequin and received all sorts of threatening letters, which she pretty much just ignored. She got a lawyer and defended herself, and she hasn't heard from them in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And that tends to be a pattern that we see a lot, which is that the corporations don't want a legal battle any more than the artists do in some cases, and they'll just pipe down when they realize that the artist isn't going to back down. So there's a certain amount of bluffing involved. I mean, one of the things that we're seeing is that the visual artists really are the ones running into the least amount of problem, you know, the least number of problems compared to musicians and compared to filmmakers. What we're seeing now with film is that it is that thing. It's becoming the habit in the industry that anything that appears in a frame, if you're shooting, especially if you're shooting on the street, if you're a documentary filmmaker and you're out there trying to capture the world. That if there's any type of recognizable image, any kind of recognizable logo or trademarked anything, that you're going to have to clear that with or go to the mm-hmm. you know owner of that copyright or that intellectual property and clear it in order to have your film be if you want it shown in theaters or shown on national television. And that's really clamping down on any type of independent filmmakers and, you know, particularly documentary filmmakers.
That's really interesting. So you either have to edit those images out somehow.
Right.
Or get permission. And since logos are essentially everywhere now.
Right. And permission is insanely overpriced. I mean, you could say, oh, it's not a big deal getting permission. But there was a case with David Guggenheim. Lawrence Lessig always tells a story in his lecture where David Guggenheim was going in. He was shooting a film that takes place. He was shooting a documentary about grade school, and it was in a classroom. And in one scene, in the back of the classroom was a TV that was showing The Simpsons. And some kids had there were I think a couple kids that had gathered around the TV and were watching it. Not a prominent part of the scene by any means, but they had to if they wanted to have the film shown for any kind of audience, they had to get it cleared. And so they went to the Simpsons, Matt Groening's lawyers, the Simpsons lawyers, and the price they quoted was $10,000 for that, you know, tiny little scene in a documentary film that is, I mean, it's insane.
There are a number of really interesting stories. I want to, you know, maybe talk about a couple more and then maybe back up and talk about how we got here. A couple other items in your exhibit. One is this thing that I think people may have seen maybe on the web, the dysfunctional family circus,
mm-hmm.
which I think is it's funny. It's a parody. Come on, folks. It's
funny,
not serious.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, too. We had a hard time locating the originator of the dysfunctional family circus because, I mean, this is how things just take off so rapidly.
Mm-hmm.
He had a friend of mine came to me and said, oh, I started this zine called Dysfunctional Family Circus, and then it started circulating, and then there was a website and blah, blah, so we were going to include this thing in the show. Well, then it turned out that there was somebody who had put out a zine a couple of years before his, that he didn't even know about that was doing pretty much the same thing. And so we, you know, ended up, you know, trying to credit everyone that we could credit with doing this. But it's just a lot of people get these get ideas simultaneously, or their, you know, their inspirations or whatever overlap or very similar. Those parties weren't sued, but there was concern about the guy who was doing the Dysfunctional Family Circus website,
yeah.
that he was hurting Bill Keen, and since he respected the artist and, you know, or was concerned about how the artist felt, he stopped doing it.
Okay.
Had he been sued, he probably could not have blamed the little ghost, not me.
Good one. There's one other, one of my favorites is this Kimbrew McLeod, Freedom of Expression. This artist essentially trademarked the phrase freedom of expression,
yeah,
and created a magazine with that title.
Yeah.
You know, Kimbrew is actually a very well-known and established scholar of intellectual property. He wrote a really interesting book called Owning Culture, uh-huh. which came out in 2001. And Kimbrough teaches at the University of Iowa. And he has been in a very interesting relationship with the entire intellectual property system because not only has he trademarked the phrase freedom of expression and had a lot of fun with it, but he has been part of the music community. He's been a songwriter. He's written fiction. He depends on copyright for his livelihood as a writer. And so he has fascinating perspective on the use and abuse and value of the system.
Mm-hmm. Well, what he did was almost performance art. It was beautiful. I mean, I don't know what you think about it, but it struck me as very funny.
Yeah, he not only trademarked freedom of expression and set up this hoax where he went after someone who had a zine by that title, he ended up threatening AT&T with a lawsuit because AT&T had last year rolled out this ad campaign that used the phrase freedom of expression. So, you know, he held a press conference about that and talked about the issue it ended up, it's the type of thing that he knew that they weren't going to, take the bait because they were on perfectly clear legal grounds, really, when it comes to
uh-huh.
that. But he was able to get this discussion going about trademarking these very,
Well, the irony is thick. The story, as I understand it, is that he enlisted a friend to pose as the publisher of a fake rock magazine called Freedom of Expression,
right.
And then he pretended to sue this person.
Exactly. That's the first part the first part he did in his hoax.
And go ahead.
I'm sorry. We're actually really lucky that he's the one who got a trademark on freedom of expression.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Because he's just playing it for pranks and to make a point. But you know, it's amazing the absurd level of protection over common phrases and ideas that are flowing around in the trademark world right now. And here's the thing about trademark. The trademark system actually makes sense. It is a system that allows for someone who's marketing a product to create some sort of stability in the marketplace. So, for instance, supposedly helps consumers, to some degree helps consumers with predictability and maybe even quality. Like every time that you pick up a red can with the words Coca-Cola on it, you're expecting that particular taste. And it would be... a very confusing and maybe even dangerous situation if we weren't so sure what we were getting every time we put our lips up to that can. So the idea of a trademark is to promote goodwill in the marketplace. And trademarks are used to be anyway limited to their particular area of commerce. So you know when Coca-Cola was only about sugared water. The idea of that trademark sort of had limited domain, but now that just about every major corporation in the world is involved in every major business in the world, their trademarks leak out into all this other space. So a communication company like AT&T could have actually fought for a trademark over freedom of expression. We have a number of examples of people trying to protect phrases and titles in ways that really go beyond any sense of fair play or common sense, to the point where I know of one particular case where a writer of some note, who I won't mention, is trying to prevent other people from using the phrase public square. Doesn't want anybody else coming up with a website called the Public Square or issuing a magazine called the Public Square, and he's trying to bully people out of that. The idea of him owning the Public Square defeats the very idea of the Public Square.
And it's also, I mean, trademark is also used to stop critics of the said company. I mean, there was one case of an anti Kmart site, and they had used the K logo in part of the site, and so Kmart, sent them a cease and desist letter, and they had to stop. I mean, there have been other incidences too, where it was preventing protesters from putting a logo on a sign or that sort of thing.
And this is the real danger. This is what we're seeing both in the area of trademark and copyright, that the habits of overprotection are so strong right now. So. It's sort of the default action of any major interested party or corporation, that these systems are actually working to censor. And they're not meant to. They were specifically designed and balanced in such a way that they would allow some incentive, but would stop before they got to the point of censorship. And American legal history is filled with cases where courts and Congress are trying to balance out these two important values in American society, so you can have commerce and have freedom. And of course, you know, there are abuses on both sides. But now we're getting to the point where both trademark and copyright are frequently being used to censor. There's one really dangerous example I want to bring up, and this actually is an important case way beyond music or culture. There's a company called Diebold. Diebold is one of the major companies that puts out electronic voting machines. Their particular machine is a disaster. It's a disaster because there's no paper trail of the votes cast. There's no way to audit the votes. And these systems are basically insecure. They're easy to hack into. Computer scientists are up in arms about how bad these voting machines are. But, of course, in the panic after the election in 2000, states and counties all over the country have been signing contracts and writing checks to Diebold to get these ridiculous machines into their polling places. Big problems for the elections, and a lot of journalists have been following this stuff. There's one journalist in particular who's out in Washington who has been posting all of the studies and complaints about Diebold voting machines on her website, and of course putting links to all of the important information, as a responsible journalist would. Well, Diebold just sent a cease and desist letter to her internet service provider saying that under this 1998 Digital Millennium Copyright Act, they have to turn off her site because these web links to their material constitute a copyright violation, which is a ridiculous claim, but it's not like the internet service provider has a team of sophisticated copyright lawyers ready to stand up and defend her rights to free speech. So her website's down. The major critic of electronic voting in this country cannot speak for the next few weeks, at least, until they sort out this problem. I mean, this is the sort of ridiculous abuse of power that companies are using, the companies are venturing into using and abusing copyright.
Well, this is a really interesting point you're making, because the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, as you mentioned, how exactly does that work? Do they actually hold the internet service provider liable if the person posting stuff on a site that is hosted there is ultimately found in violation?
Well, yeah, this is how there are a bunch of provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, but three that are causing the most trouble right now. One is the anti-circumvention provision, which has to do with hacking past or getting past encryption or access control device on things like DVDs. But and that's a very complicated notion. The part of the DMCA that's in play in this story is what's called notice and takedown. What the DMCA tried to do was take copyright out of the courts, take it out of the realm of human beings making reasonable decisions and negotiating among themselves, and tried to make copyright enforcement a private function. So what it did was it said, look, any time that a copyright holder notifies an internet service provider that there may be an infringement, the internet service provider has to click the switch and ask questions later. The internet service provider becomes the copyright cop in that case. The internet service provider might be your company, it might be America Online, it might be Google, it might be a university, it might be the federal government. There are all sorts of real serious problems with this, but what it really comes down to is a complete absence of due process. Nobody goes through and has an evidentiary hearing on whether this really is a copyright violation. Nobody investigates whether the company actually controls the copyright to the content in question. Basically, the ISP is in a situation where, okay, it could hire a lawyer, it could mount a defense for somebody else, or it could just flip the switch and be done with the problem. So that's exactly what's happening in many cases. It's happening to websites that are parodies, which are clearly, you know, examples of fair use. It's happened to websites that criticize major corporations, and this is an even more serious problem, because this gets to the heart of our working democracy at its own.
We're past our midpoint here. I want to mention again our guests. We're talking with Carrie McLaren. She's creator of the illegal art exhibit that is touring major U.S. museums, next up in Philadelphia, and also Siva Vaidyanathan. He's a professor of communications at New York University, author of the book Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, The Rise of Intellectual Property and How It Threatens Creativity. And we're talking about the clash between art, creativity, and copyrights and intellectual property. We have one caller waiting and would welcome others if you want to join our conversation. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Anywhere else, 800-222-9455. I have some other questions. We have a listener waiting. Let's talk with them. First, listener in Champaign on line number one. Good morning.
Hello. I was wondering about the name of the journalist with the Diebold voting machines. That sounds interesting and something I'd like to check into. Also, along the same lines, is there do you know of any particular local or national ISPs who have a reputation for standing up to this kind of intimidation? Are there places where people like this journalist can go once they're shut down? Are there any other options, I guess I'm wondering?
The journalist's name is Bev Harris, and she's very intent on getting her work out there, so I'm sure she wouldn't mind me saying her name on the radio. To get information about this case, go to my weblog. It's civacracy.net. That's civacracy.net. I have a bunch of postings up there about this case, there are plenty of other sites around the web that are following this as well. And you can contact her. Her email's posted up on my weblog as well. Now, as far as ISPs, yes, some ISPs have been better to their consumers than others. Verizon, for instance, has been vigilant in protecting its users' privacy when it comes to peer-to-peer accusations about file sharing. But no ISP is in the position to defend something that is just posted on the web, unfortunately. The only ISPs I know that have sort of behaved in a more enlightened way are those that are sort of by charter supposed to be more enlightened, meaning universities.
Right.
But even then, they haven't been great about defending the freedom of expression for their students or their faculty in all cases. And I apologize to Kimberly McLeod for using the phrase freedom of expression without permission.
All right, thanks.
Thanks very much for the call. Okay, I want to talk a little bit more about the history of this. And by way of example, I'd like to play one more music track that's off this illegal art CD. Now, I want to warn listeners that this is rough listening. This is very controversial material and not for the faint of heart. So let's play this track and then we'll talk about it.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to you.
All right, there it is. Happy birthday to you. This is currently owned by AOL Time Warner. Is that correct?
That's what I understand, yes.
And how does a song like that get owned by a corporation?
Well, it's the composition rights. The composition rights are different than the recording rights.
Right, okay.
The
right.
Composition rights are owned by a corporation because those composition rights are often for sale. The composition rights for the Beatles tunes were for sale and ultimately purchased by Michael Jackson. Just like anything, you can sell the rights to just about anything. And that is how rights transfer is really how the music economy works. Now, interestingly, AOL Time Warner owns this, and sometimes they've been known to be difficult when it comes to enforcing control over this song, and they've certainly taken a lot of heat for it. Very interesting example, on Aaron Sorkin's show Sports Night, which dearly departed show, it ran for a season, I believe, a couple of years ago. There was one particular episode when one of the sportscasters sang it to the other sportscaster and got in big trouble with the lawyers at the network for this very reason, and had a lot of fun talking about how absurd it was that he couldn't sing Happy Birthday on the air. It turns out, of course, that Aaron Sorkin's father is the chief lawyer for AOL Time Warner. So it was sort of an inside family joke.
Wow.
In that case.
Well, that's really interesting. Siva, I wanted to back up and, you know, as you do in your book, Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, talk about how this all came about, because copyright law wasn't always such a difficult thing for freedom of expression, if I can borrow that term again from our colleague in Iowa.
Right.
That its purpose was not just to protect the economic interest of the creators or owners of a work, but also to encourage its distribution and people's access to it.
Precisely. The roots of American copyright are, of course, British. It goes back to the British Isles and the sort of political and legal and intellectual battles of the 17th and early 18th centuries. And in England, for a good number of years, the system that morphed into copyright was actually an instrument of censorship. During the founding of the American Republic, there was a strong awareness of that level of abuse. And the founding fathers, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, had a very strong sense that if we're going to create a monopoly system, let's make it a limited monopoly so that copyrights eventually expire and the works that have cost the public monopoly prices would eventually go back to the public, would eventually enter the public domain. The price of books would drop after copyright expired. People could easily build on, revise, and work with material after the copyrights expired. So the original copyright terms were very short, 14 years, followed by a 14-year renewal. And eventually, they would add years to that. Now we're up to the point where copyrights last life of the author plus 70 years. And as our lives get longer, we're approaching almost 190 years at this point, as long as a copyright could last. So we have this absurd level of protection, and every time that major works approach expiration, big corporations like Disney run to Congress and tack on another 20 years to that term. So this has been the habit for the last few decades. Now, over the course of American history, up until just the last 20 years, American copyright was pretty healthy and pretty reasonable. It recognized that there is a public interest in keeping books inexpensive. There was a public interest in allowing people to build on previous works. There's a public interest in allowing for schools and universities to use intellectual property without payment or permission, low cost. There's a public interest in allowing for rich debate, dialogue, and criticism and parody. But that's all gone out the window now. Congress no longer cares about those sorts of public interest issues like freedom of expression. So the political power in Washington has essentially corrupted our American copyright system. So that sort of free speech or democratic fail-safes that were built into copyright over 200 years have now been closed off.
Well, let's talk about how this plays out in the modern technological economic system then, because at the same time that all these things are legally protected, for the people who have bothered to copyright or trademark or otherwise protect their intellectual property, technology has made it so much easier to sample and to copy and to borrow or refer to link things. It almost seems like it's a recipe for chaos for the artist.
It is. It's a very scary time to try to make a living as a creative person. It's harder and harder to charge monopoly rents for your own material. It's harder and harder to depend on the public to believe and trust in the foundations of these values and legal systems. And we've essentially built for ourselves a ridiculous, absurd system where it's harder than ever to make legitimate, fair use of copyrighted material. It's harder than ever for me to distribute a newspaper article in a classroom without fear of getting in trouble. Mm-hmm. But it's easier than ever for me to download entire movies from the internet or walk down about six blocks from my apartment and buy any currently released movie on a pirated DVD from the street. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can get almost anything for low price illicitly now,
but it's really hard to make legitimate use. It's really hard for artists to make legitimate use of the raw material, and that's exactly what Carrie McLaren has shown in her her exhibit. But it's easier than ever to completely flout the principles of copyright. This has undermined public support for copyright. This has undermined the norms that any legal system depends on. We've essentially set the speed limit at 35 miles an hour, and we're shocked that people are driving 50. And that's no way to design a regulatory system. And we're really hurting ourselves, because copyright has worked brilliantly for most of the past 200 years, and it has filled our libraries with books, and it has supported a bunch of really talented people in a reasonable way. But now we've increased the level of enforcement to such a degree that nobody has any faith in it. And now that we all have the tools to do our own production and distribution, we really have to depend on social norms more than ever.
Mm-hmm. Carrie McLaren, you're involved in the artistic community. How do artists dealing with this? I mean, it seems that it's something that if I'm an artist, I would have to suddenly, you know, be thinking, you know, looking over my shoulder, or maybe intentionally flouting the line a little bit, maybe. I don't know.
Well, I think what they do is, they respond, different people respond different way depending on what their life situation is. But what we see, a lot of cases, people just limiting themselves, you know, drastically limiting what kind of work they do. I mean, we did with the exhibit, we did a issue of my Stay Free, which is my magazine, and we did an interview with Hank Shockley and Chuck D from Public Enemy, and they talked extensively about how copyright has changed, drastically changed hip hop in a decade, and changed their own music, and has obviated a whole style of hip hop that, you know, what we associate. Public Enemy's producer, or, you know, the bomb squad, which Hank Shockley was part of, with their sound was characterized by this dense collage of samples that were drawn from many, many different sources, and they would be very short, obscure, you know, it would be very difficult to source them. And that is what made their first few records so rich, is that it was so dense, and you know, there were other artists who were doing that sort of thing, Beastie Boys and NWA and some of these other Ice Cube make right. This type of sound. But hip hop now, the only type of things that they can do are to sample. You know, the very wealthy can sample what they like, but generally what they'll do is stick with a couple of samples, because it's much cheaper to do that. It's much more affordable than to do this type of collage, which now you pretty much just can't do, because you're talking about thousands and thousands of dollars per sample.
I'm so glad you brought this up, Carrie. We need to mention, of course, that interview in Stay Free magazine was conducted by Kembrew McLeod.
who
owns the trademark for freedom of expression. But this story of how Public Enemy had to abandon its wall of sound, its brilliant collage that had drawn so many people into the hip-hop universe, that's why I started writing Copyrights and Copy Wrongs, because of Public Enemy. I was a huge fan in the late 80s, and by the early 90s, I noticed this very thing. I noticed that the deep, rich, playful, meaningful language of sampling had suddenly become devoid of any wit, devoid of any playfulness, devoid of any strong politics. And I said, what the heck happened to the music? And I knew I'd read in Rolling Stone and a few other places that there had been a series of lawsuits over sampling. And I thought, you know, what if the legal system is dictating to artists what they can and should do? And what if now, because there's so much money in the world of hip-hop, that there's basically a closed system for clearing these samples? That would be an amazing story to tell. So that's where my research started. I was in graduate school at the University of Texas, and I thought, this is what I want to write a book about. And I started looking into what happened with a series of rap sampling cases, and that was exactly what happened. 1991, a federal judge turned out the lights on on transgressive sampling, on unauthorized sampling. So now you have to get permission, and if you're making fun of somebody, they're not going to give you permission, and they're going to charge you a lot of money, and they may charge you a percentage of the royalties you make down the line. And if you don't hire lawyers up front, you don't get the stuff cleared, and if you can't afford lawyers up front, you can't market your stuff. So this has meant, this has driven a lot of interesting artists underground, but it's also enriched people like P. Diddy, who do ridiculously simple musical production. And it's meant that real talented geniuses, like the folks with Public Enemy, are having to compromise their art, and they feel really upset about it. And this sort of curiosity drove me to look at the entire history of American copyright law and say, how did we get into this mess? And it was able to sort of take me through all these different avenues in film and music and, and literature.
Well, it's a great book, and it's actually very easy to read. So if people want to learn more, it'd be a very good source. We just have about 2 or 3 minutes left, and I want to make sure to give Carrie McLaren a chance to talk a little bit more about the illegal art exhibit, which is going to Philadelphia. Where are you going in Philadelphia, Carrie?
It's going to be at Nexus Gallery. And then we're also going to be doing a series of film shows at the Prince Theater. There's going to be a panel on Saturday in which Steve is a part.
Okay.
So.
It'll be a blast.
Right.
If you're in Philadelphia, or near Philadelphia, definitely look up illegal art.
What's the reaction been like to people who see the exhibit?
Well, I mean, very enthusiastic, I would say.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of, it's helped, increase the profile of State Free. Our website has been, we've had to, juice up the memory and stuff. We have all the films and all the songs people can download from our website, which is illegal-art.org. It's been a good thing.
By the way, we'll put a link to your website on our webpage that has the archive of this interview. Hopefully, I'm not violating any anything
well,
serious.
No, that's the thing. Web links are not copyright violations.
Uh-huh.
They shouldn't be, but for some reason, you got a bunch of lawyers out there who
think they are.
They're going to make it illegal.
That's right. Stay Free Magazine. Well, there's a link to Stay Free Magazine on your website as well. I wanted to ask, are there things that people who are, patrons or consumers of art or artists, what should people be doing to deal with these issues?
Yeah, first and foremost, you should be prepared to converse with your congressman and senator about these issues. If you think the situation is absurd, let them know. In 1998, when they passed all these bad laws, nobody was speaking up except the librarians. Librarians saw these issues coming down the line, and they said, wait a minute, we're making some big mistakes here. Librarians don't have as much political power in Washington as the Disney Corporation does. But, librarians have direct contact with voters, and voters actually have more power than the Disney Corporation. So talk to your librarians about these issues. Talk to artists in your community about these issues. And if you get a chance to talk to your congressman or get a chance to talk to your senator, bring it up. Say, look, our copyright system is upside down. It's no longer favoring artists, and people no longer have faith in the system. We need to get back to those foundational American values that include freedom and incentives.
There are also, there's a group called the Creative Commons, which is working to have outreach to creative people and archivists and that sort of thing to use alternative licenses rather than the standard copyright and licenses that will allow their work to be shared. I mean, it's in this tradition of the open source code and that type of thing where people can allow their work to, to follow different rules, and they can register with the Creative Commons website.
Mm-hmm. Precisely. There's also an organization in Washington, D.C. called publicknowledge.org,
mm-hmm.
Public knowledge as one word. They are becoming the point people for activism and lobbying in Washington, D.C. for the public interest. So they're working for you.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to stop because we're out of time, and I'm sorry to say there's much more we could talk about, but there are resources here on the web, certainly, for folks who'd like to know more. One website, good starting point, is illegal-art.org, Carrie McLaren's website, and that'll also take you to her magazine, Stay Free. And our guests again have been Carrie McLaren, curator of the Illegal Art Exhibit, and Siva Vaidyanathan, author of the book Copyrights and Copy Wrongs. To both of you, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.